and took the pressure from our flanks. The tips of her wands, both of them made of ivory, were cracked and chipped. Her arms hung limply and swung at her sides, and she looked even paler now than she had going in. She turned to me, gave me a quivering smile, and then suddenly sank to the ground, her eyes rolling back in her head. I stared at her in shock for a second, and then I was on my knees next to her, my amulet glowing as I used its light to check her for injuries. In the chaos, I hadn't seen that one of her legs, at mid-thigh, was a mass of blood. One of the wild shots from the security goons had hit her beneath the armored vest. She was bleeding out. She was dying. Thomas crashed to the ground next to me. He ripped off his belt and whipped it around her leg as a tourniquet. "I've got this," he said, looking up at me, his expression remote, calm. "Go. Go." I stared at him for a second, uncertain. Molly was my apprentice, my responsibility. He stared at me, and his calm mask cracked for a second, showing me his tension, the fear he was holding in check at the scale of the conflict around us. "Harry," he said, "I'll guard her with my life. I swear it." I nodded, and then clenched a fist, looking around. That much spilled blood would start drawing vampires to the wounded girl like bees to flowers. Thomas couldn't care for her and fight. "Mouse," I called, "stay with them." The dog rushed over to Molly and literally stood over her head, his eyes and ears everywhere, a guardian determined not to fail. Then I ran to Murphy and Sonya, who both bore small cuts and abrasions and who looked like they were about to charge into the nearest portion of the fray. Martin tagged along with me, apparently calm, and by all appearances, unaware that he was in the middle of a battle. Say what I would about Martin, his blandness, his boring demeanor, and his non-combative body language were very real armor in this situation. He simply didn't look like an important or threatening target, and he was untouched. I looked around them and picked up a sword that had been dropped by one of the warriors they had killed, a simple Chinese straight sword known as a jian. It was light, razor sharp on both edges, and suited me just fine. "We're going to the pyramid," I called to Murphy and Sonya. A group of 30 or 40 Kenku went over us, witch shadows against the rising moon, and entered the fray against the jaguar warriors who still stood between us and an exit from the ball court. "There," I said. "Go, go, go." I suited action to my words and plunged toward the opening Ebenezer's allies were cutting for us. There was a surge of magic and a flash of motion ahead of us as another vampire noble tossed another flare of power at me. I caught a small stroke of lightning on my mentor's staff. It was shorter, thicker, and heavier than mine, conducting the attack down my arm, across my shoulder, and out the tip of my newly acquired sword. The lightning bolt chewed a hole in the belly of the Red Court noble. He staggered as I closed on him. I spun the staff to the horizontal and checked him in the nose as I went by, dropping him to the ground. We went past the remains of the temple and out into the open space between the buildings. It was chaos out there. Jaguar warriors and priest types were everywhere, and most of them were armed. Mortal security folks were forming into teams and racing toward the ball court to reinforce the Red Court. I realized that at some point Murphy, her clothing shining with white light, her halo a blaze of molten gold, had begun racing along on my right side, with Sonya on my left. The brilliant light of the two swords was a terror to the vampires and half-breeds alike, and they recoiled from that aura of power and fear, but that wasn't the same thing as retreating. They simply fell back, while other creatures closed a large circle about us, drawing it slowly tighter as we moved toward the pyramid. "We aren't going to make it," Murphy said. "They're getting ready to rush us from all sides."
"Always they are doing that," Sonya said,
panting, his cheerful voice going slightly annoyed.
"Never is it anything new."
They were right. I could sense the change in motion of the villains around us, how they were retreating more slowly before us, pressing in more closely behind us. I felt my eyes drawn up to the pyramid ahead of us, and there, standing on the fifth level of the pyramid, looking down, was a figure in a golden mask. Evidently, one of the lords of Outer Night had been knocked all the way over to the pyramid by Ebenezer's entrance, and I could feel his will at work in the foes around us, not used to overcome an enemy with immobility now, but to infuse his troops with confidence and aggression. That guy, I said, nodding at him. Gold mask. We take him down and we're through. Murphy scanned the pyramid until she spotted him. Then her eyes tracked down to the base of the stairs, and she nodded shortly. Right, she said. And she raised Fidelacius, let out a scream that had startled a great many large men working out at her dojo, and plunged into the warriors of the Red Court like a swimmer breasting a wave. Sonya blinked. Holy crap, I hadn't meant she should do that. Tiny, Sonya said, letting out a belly laugh as he began to move. But fierce. You're all insane, I screamed and plunged forward with them, while Martin backpedaled and tried to keep up with us, while simultaneously warding off the vampires closing in from behind. Murphy did what no mortal should have been able to do. She cut a path through a mob of warrior vampires. She went through them as if they'd been no more than a cloud of smoke. Fidelacius blazed, and no weapon raised against the Sword of Faith, neither modern steel nor living relic, could withstand its edge. Murphy hardly seemed to actually attack anyone. She simply moved forward, and when attacks came at her, bad things happened to whoever had attempted to strike her. Sword thrusts were slid gently aside while she continued onward, her own blade seeming to naturally, independently pass through an S-shaped slash upon the opponent's body on the way through, wreaking terrible damage with delicate speed. Warriors who flung themselves upon her found their hands grabbing nothing, their bodies being sent tumbling through the air, and that horrible sword of light left wounds in each and every opponent, their edges black and sizzling. They'd come at her in twos, and once three of the Jaguar warriors managed to coordinate an attack. It didn't do them any good. Murphy had been handling opponents who were bigger and stronger and faster than her in situations of real danger since she was a rookie cop. The vampires and half-breeds, swift and strong as they were, seemed no more able to beat her down than had all of those thugs and criminals. Stronger though her enemies were, the blazing light of the sword seemed to slow them, to undermine their strength. Not much, but enough to make the difference. Murphy dodged and feinted and tossed warriors into one another, using their own strength against them. The three-on-one she faced almost seemed unfair. One of the Jaguar warriors, armed with an enormous club, wound up smashing his two compatriots, courtesy of the intern knight, only to find his club sliced into three pieces that wound up on the ground next to his own severed leg. Karen Murphy led the charge, and Sonya and I tried to keep up. She went through that sea of foes like a little speedboat, her enemies spun and tossed and turned and disoriented in her wake. Sonya and I hacked our way through stunned foes, pushing and chopping with unsophisticated brutality, and that big Russian lunatic just kept laughing the whole time. We hit the stairs, and resistance thinned sharply. Murphy surged ahead, and the Lord of Outer Night raised a bejeweled hand against her, his sheer will causing the air to ripple and thicken. Sonya and I hit it like a brick wall and staggered to a halt, but it seemed to slide off of Murphy, as had every other attack to come at her, her halo burning still brighter. Panicked, the enemy raised a hand and sent three shafts of sorcerous power howling at her, one right after another. Murphy's feet, sure and swift on the stairs, carried her into a version of a boxer's bobbing dance, and each shaft went blazing uselessly past her. Sonya yelped and dropped, dodging the bolt that nearly clobbered him. I blocked one on my shield and took the other in the shin. My godmother's armor protected my flesh, but I hit the stone stairs of the pyramid pretty hard. I jerked my eyes up in time to see Murphy rush the Lord of Outer Night and speed straight past him, her sword sweeping up in a single upward vertical slash. The gold mask fell from the vampire's head, along with the front half of its skull. Silver fire burned at the revealed twisted lumpy lobes of the vampire's brain, and as its blood flowed out and touched that fire, it went up in a sudden pyre of silver-white flame. The Lord of Outer Night somehow managed to scream as fire consumed it, and flung more bursts of magic blindly and in all directions for several more seconds, until it finally fell into blackened ash and ugly smears on the stone. Only then did the barrier of its will vanish, and Sonya, Martin, and I hustled up the stairs toward the temple. Still, the enemy pursued us. There were so damn many of them. And as I gained more height, I was able to look back and see that the Red Court had begun to contain the Kenku incursion. The battle was still furiously underway within the ball court, and though the feathered warriors were the match of any two or three vampires or half-breeds, the enemy had numbers to spare. I could only be grateful that so many of their spell-slingers were duking it out with the Grey Council instead of getting in our way. "Damn it," I said, looking up the steps toward the temple at their summit. Shadows moved inside. "Damn it!" I looked around me wildly and suddenly felt a hand grasp mine, where I clutched my staff. Murphy shook my hand until I looked at her. "Sonya and I will stay here," she said, panting. "We'll hold them until you get Maggie." I looked down the slope of the pyramid. Hundreds of the Red Court were coming up, and they were tearing free of their flesh masks now, revealing the monsters beneath. Hold them? It would be suicide. The swords gave their wielders immense power against things out of nightmares, but it didn't make them superhuman. Murphy and Sonya had both been fighting for 20 minutes, and there is no aerobic exercise that compares with the physical demands of combat. Both of them were breathing hard, growing tired. Suicide. But I needed to get up there. "Dresden!" Martin called. "Come on!" I hadn't even realized he was shaking me, trying to get me up the stairs. I guess I was getting pretty tired, too. I narrowed my focus to Martin, to the stairs up, and tried to ignore the burning in my arms, my legs, my chest. I drew in a sharp breath, and it was like inhaling sudden, cool, clean wind. I thought I heard someone whispering to me, something in a tongue I didn't understand, but I knew my queen's voice. I became aware that a cloud of white mist and vapor was gathering around me as I continued, a little faster, the humid air of the Yucatan boiling around the frost that had formed on my armor. Then the cold washed away the hot fatigue, and I felt the ice flowing into me, implacable, merciless, relentless. My legs began to churn like the pistons of an engine. Suddenly, one step per stride simply wasn't enough, and I started flying up them two at a time, rapidly leaving Martin behind. I reached the top, and a half-breed jaguar warrior flung himself toward me. I snarled, batted his sword aside with mine, and lashed out with one foot, landing a stomping kick in the center of his chest. His sternum cracked audibly, and he flew backward as if hit by a truck. He hit the stone wall behind him hard enough to shake dust from the roof overhead and crumpled like a broken toy. Which was exactly the kind of power the Winter Knight was supposed to have, and I watched the poor idiot drop with satisfaction. The square temple had four doorways, one on each side, and in the one to my immediate right a vampire, torn free of its flesh mask, appeared, a jaguar skin still draped over its shoulders. It clutched an obsidian knife in its hand, the Red King's dagger. It was the vamp he dispatched to kill Maggie. "Fog of war, huh?" I asked him, and felt myself smiling. "Buddy, did you ever walk through the wrong door at the wrong time?" Its eyes flicked to the floor to my left for an instant, and I looked too. Maggie crouched there, directly between the altar and the door on my left, chained and shivering, huddling low to the ground, as if hoping to be overlooked. "Go on," I said, looking back at the vampire. I bounced the sword in my hand lightly. White mist poured off the blade, so did a few snowflakes. "Go for it, tough guy. Take one step toward that girl and see what happens." The door opposite me suddenly darkened. The Red King and no fewer than four of his lords stood there, gold masks shining, throwing back weird reflections from the dazzling array of flickering lights and fires in the darkness outside. His face twisted with rage, and his will and the wills of the lords behind him fell upon me like blows from individual sledgehammers. I staggered, planted my mentor's staff firmly on the stone floor, and barely kept myself from being driven to the ground. "Now," the Red King said, his voice strangled with fury, "put that little bitch on the altar." One of the lords stepped forward and bent down to seize the child by her hair. Maggie screamed.
"No!"
I shouted. The Red King stepped forward and kicked the corpse of the dead woman from the altar. mortal, he spat, still so certain that his will matters. But you are nothing, a wisp, a shadow, here and then gone, forgotten. It is fated. It is the way of the universe. He jerked the ritual knife from the hands of the warrior and glared at me, his true nature writhing and twisting beneath his skin. The Lord dragged the screaming child to the altar, and the Red King's black eyes gleamed. This is your only role, mortal, he said. Your only grace, the only thing you are truly meant to do. He stared at Maggie and bared his teeth, all long fangs, slaver running out of his mouth and down over his chin. Die! Chapter 48. The Red King raised the knife over my daughter, and she let out a quavering little scream, a helpless, hopeless wail of terror and despair. And as hard as I fought with the new strength given me by Queen Mab, with the protection granted by my godmother's armor, I could not do a damn thing about it. I didn't have to. White light erupted over the altar from no visible source, and the Red King let out a scream. The shackles of his will vanished, even as his right hand, the one holding the stone knife, leapt off his arm and went spinning through the air. It fell to the stone floor, still clutched hard around the leather-wrapped hilt of the knife, and the obsidian blade shattered like a dropped dish. I let out a shout as I felt the Red King's will slip off of me. The others still held me in place, but I suddenly knew that I could move, knew that I could fight. As the Red King reeled back, screaming, I lifted a hand, snarled, "Fuego!" and sent a wash of fire to my right, engulfing the jaguar warrior who still stood a couple of feet inside the doorway. He tried to flee, and only wound up screaming and falling down the deadly steep steps of the pyramid, while the soul fire lacing my spell found his flesh and set it aflame. I whirled back to the lords, facing me from the far side of the altar. I couldn't have risked throwing destructive energy at them with my daughter lying on the altar between us, and I had no choice but to take out the immediate threat of the warrior so that I could focus on the lords and the Red King. Otherwise, it would have been relatively simple for him to come over and cut my throat while I was engaged by the vampire elite. But two can play at that game, and my physical backup was a hell of a lot better than theirs. I drew in my own will and lifted my borrowed staff, and as I did, four more beings in golden masks entered the temple. Where did all those yo-yos come from?
Hold the wizard!
Snarled the Red King, and the pressure of hostile minds upon me abruptly doubled. My left arm shook, and the staff I held in it slowly sank down. My right arm just ran out of gas, as if the muscles in it had become totally exhausted, and the tip of the sword clinked as it hit the stone floor. The Red King rose and stared for a moment at the altar and at the column of shimmering light over it. As he did, his freaking hand began to writhe like a spider, and a second later it flipped itself over and began to crawl back over toward him. The king just stood there, staring at the light. I tried to fight my way out of the mass of dark will directed against me. The light could only be Susan veiled behind the Lenanshi's handiwork and wielding Amarakius. I mean, how many invisible sources of holy light interested in protecting my daughter could there be running around Chichen Itza? She hadn't attacked yet, instead standing over Maggie. I wanted to scream at her to take him, that it was her only chance. If she didn't, the Red King and his lords could take her out almost as swiftly and easily as I had the Jaguar Warrior. But he didn't. And in a flash of insight, I understood why he didn't. He didn't know what the light was. He knew only that it hurt him when he tried to murder the child. From his perspective, it could have been almost anything. An archangel standing guard, or a spirit of light as terrible as the Ick had been foul. I thought back to the voice coming from Murphy's mouth, pronouncing judgment upon the Red Court, and suddenly understood what was making the Red King hesitate. What he was really thinking, that the entity over the altar might be something he did not think actually existed, like maybe the real Kukulkan, and he was afraid. Susan couldn't do anything. If she acted, if she revealed what she was, the enemy's uncertainty would vanish, and the conflict would immediately ensue again. Outnumbered so heavily, she wouldn't have a chance. But she knew what she had, in uncertainty and fear, and she neither moved nor made a sound. It was a weapon as potent as the wills of the demigods themselves. It had, after all, paralyzed the Red King. But it was a fragile weapon, a sword made of glass, and I felt my eyes drawn to the broken pieces of obsidian on the floor. I couldn't move, and time was not our ally. With every moment that passed, the more numerous enemy would become more organized, recover more from the shock of the sudden invasion of a small army smack in the middle of their holiday celebration. I needed an opportunity, a moment, if I was going to get Maggie out of this mess, and I needed it soon. I strained against the wills of the Lords of Outer Night, unable to move, and keeping their attention locked upon me. One by one, my gaze traveled over each of the golden masks. I focused on the last one for a time, then began again with the first, tried to test each individual will to find out which would be the weakest point of attack when my moment came. Just then, Martin ghosted into the temple through the fourth door, making absolutely no sound, and it looked to me like the moment was freaking nigh. All of the lords present were focused on me. The Red King stood intently, distracted by Susan's light show, while his severed hand crawled its way up his leg and hopped over to his wounded arm, where rubbery tendrils of black ooze immediately extruded from whole and wounded flesh alike and began intertwining. Martin had walked into what had to be a Fellowship operative's wet dream. The Red King's naked back, and no one to stop him from going medieval on the leader of the vile edifice of power and terror that was the Red Court. He took the machete from its sheath without a whisper of steel on nylon and drew back, readying himself to strike. There was an intensity of focus in his face that I had never seen before. He closed the last two steps in a super quick blur, went into a spin, and I was getting ready to cheer. When his foot swept up to streak savagely through the air beneath the glowing white light. I heard Susan let out a cry as she fell, startled by the blow. Martin, moving with his eyes closed, got close to her arms lashing out and caught something between them. He ripped hard with his left arm, twisting the machete up with the right as he did, and suddenly Susan was fully visible, bowed into a pain arch by Martin's grip on her. The feather cloak had fallen from her, and the blade of Martin's machete rested against her throat. I screamed in rage. It came out as a sort of vocalized seethe. The Red King took a swift step back as Martin attacked, his eyes intent. Then when Susan appeared, his head tilted as he worked through what he was seeing. "Please excuse me, my lord," Martin murmured, giving a slight bow of his head to the Red King. "Drop it," he said in a flat voice to Susan. He twisted his body more, bending her painfully, and pressing the machete's edge against her throat even harder, until Susan's fingers opened and Amorakius fell to the floor, its light slowly dying. "A trick," said the Red King. Anger began to pour off of him. "A charlatan's trick." His eyes moved from Susan up to Martin. "And you have revealed yourself." "I beg your forgiveness, my lord," Martin said. "It seemed the proper time. On my initiative, strike teams began removing Fellowship personnel and safe houses 2 hours ago. By this time tomorrow, there won't be an operative left alive south of the United States, and our financial division will have taken or destroyed well over 90% of their accounts."
"You son of a bitch," Susan said, her voice overflowing with pain. "You fucking traitor!"
Martin's expression flickered at her words, but his eyes never left the Red King. "I give you the Fellowship of St. Giles, my lord," he said, "and I beg you to grant me my reward."
"Reward?"
Susan said, loading more contempt and hate into the word than should have been possible. "What could they possibly give you, Martin, to make it worth what you've done?" The Red King stared at Susan and said, Explain it to her. You misunderstand, Martin said calmly. I have not betrayed the Fellowship, Susan. This was the plan from the moment I joined it. Think. You've known me for less than a decade, and you've seen how near some of our scrapes have been. Did you truly believe I had survived 150 years of battle against the Red Court, outlived every other operative ever to serve the Fellowship on my own merits? He shook his head. No. Escapes were provided, as were targets. It took me 50 years, and I had to personally kill two of my fellows and friends, working much as I was to win the trust of the Fellowship. Once they admitted me to the inner circle, their time had come. Trust is a poison, Susan. It took another century to ferret out their secrets, but it is finally done. And our people will finish removing the Fellowship, in every meaningful sense, by tomorrow. It is over. Susan's eyes flickered over to me, and Maggie continued to weep quietly, huddling in on herself. Susan's face was twisted with pain. There were furious tears in her eyes as she looked at me. And I couldn't even speak to her.
And what do you get?
Susan asked him, voice shaking. Ascension, said the Red King. I have no interest in admitting bloodthirsty lunatics to the nobility of my court. Martin has proven himself. His dedication, his self-control, and, most important, his competence over the course of decades. He was a priest for 50 years before he was even permitted to attempt this service. Honestly, Susan, Martin said, I told you many times that you can never let emotion interfere with your duties. If you had listened to me, I'm certain you would have caught on. I would have been forced to kill you, as I have several others who were too wise for their own good, but you would have known. Susan closed her eyes. She was shaking.
Of course.
You could make contact as often as you wished, every time I visited Maggie.
Correct, he said quietly.
He turned back to the Red King. My lord, I beg your forgiveness. I sought only to give you that which you wished, and the timing made it necessary for me to act, or see the opportunity pass us by.
Under the circumstances, I think I will not object, priest, the Red King said. If the strike teams are as successful as you predict, you will have your reward and my gratitude.
Martin bowed his head to the Red King, and then looked up at me. He studied my face for a moment before he said, The wizard has Alamaya's dagger in his sash, my lord, should you wish to complete the ritual. The Red King took a deep breath and then blew it out, his expression becoming almost benevolent.
Martin, Martin, the voice of practicality. We've been lost without you.
My lord is too kind, Martin said. Please accept my condolences on the loss of Ariana, my lord. She was a remarkable woman.
Remarkably ambitious, the Red King said, determined to cling to the past rather than exploring new opportunities. She and her entire coterie determined to undermine me. Had she destroyed this animal and then made good upon her promise to break the back of the accursed White Council, she would have been a real threat to my power. I take no pleasure in thinking on it, but her death was meant to be.
As you say, my lord, Martin said. The Red King approached me, smiling, and reached for the dagger in my sash. Susan bared her teeth, still straining, but Martin was more than her equal, it seemed. There was nothing I could do. The deck had been stacked so hard against me that even with Martin on our side, things had looked grim. His treachery had come at the ideal moment. Damn him. Damn them all. There was nothing I could... Long ago, when I was little more than a child, my first lover and I had devised a spell to let us speak silently to each other in class. It was magic much like the speaking stone Ebenezer had crafted, but simpler, with a much shorter range. I had never used it to communicate with anyone but Elaine, but Susan had been intimate with me, and I thought that at that moment the only thought on our minds was Maggie. It might be enough to establish the link, even if it was only one way. I grasped for the minor magic, fighting to pull it together through the dragging chains of the wills of the lords of Outer Night, and cast my thought at Susan as clearly as I could.
"He doesn't know all of it,"
I sent to her desperately.
"He doesn't know about the enchantment protecting your skin. He only knows about the cloak, because he saw you use it when we got here."
Susan's eyes widened briefly. She'd heard me.
"The altar,"
I thought.
"The ritual meant to kill us can be turned back upon them. If one of them dies on that knife, the curse will go after their bloodline, not ours."
Her eyes widened more. I saw her thinking furiously.
"Martin," she asked quietly, "why did Ariana target my daughter?"
Martin looked down at Susan, at Maggie, and then away.
"Because the child's father is the son of Margaret Le Fay, the daughter of the man who killed her husband. By killing her, this way she would avenge herself upon all of you."
If I hadn't already been more or less motionless, I would have frozen in place.
Margaret Le Fay,
daughter of the man who had killed Ariana's husband and vampire child, Paolo Ortega. Duke Ortega, who had been destroyed by the Blackstaff. Ebenezer McCoy, one of the most dangerous wizards in the world. A man of such personal and political power that she would never have been able to take him down directly. So she had set out to strike at him through his bloodline. From him to my mother, from her to me, from me to Maggie. Kill the child and kill us all.
That's what Ariana had meant when she said it wasn't about me. It was about my grandfather.
Suddenly it made sense that the old man had put his life on the line by declaring himself my mentor when the council would have killed me for slaying Justin de Morne. Suddenly it made sense why he had been so patient with me, so considerate, so kind. It hadn't just been an act of random kindness. And suddenly it made sense why he would barely ever speak of his apprentice, Margaret Le Fay, a name she'd earned for herself when her birth certificate must have read Margaret McCoy. Hell, for that matter, he probably never told the council that Margaret was his daughter. I sure as hell had no intentions of letting them know about Maggie if I got her out of this mess. My mother had eventually been killed by enemies she had made, and Ebenezer, her father, the most dangerous man on the White Council, had not been there to save her. The circumstances wouldn't matter. No matter what he'd accomplished, I knew the old man would never forgive himself for not saving his daughter's life, any more than I would if I failed Maggie. It was why he had made a statement, a demonstration of what would happen to those who came at me with a personal vengeance. He was trying, preemptively, to save his grandson. And it explained why he had changed the Grey Council's focus and led them here. He had tried to save me, and to save my little girl. And, some cynical portion of me added, himself. Though I wasn't even sure that would be a conscious thought on his part, underneath the mountain of issues he had accrued. No wonder Ariana had been so hot and bothered to use the bloodline curse, starting with Maggie. She'd avenge herself upon me, who hadn't had the good grace to die in a duel, and upon Ebenezer, who had simply killed Ortega as you would a dangerous animal. A workaday murder performed with expedience and an extremely high profile. Ariana must have lost a lot of face in the wake of that. And my ongoing exploits against the Reds and their allies would only have made her more determined to show me my place. With a single curse, she'd kill one of the senior council and the Black Staff all at once. My death would be something to crow about, too, since, as Ariana herself had noted, no one had pulled it off yet. And I felt I could confidently lay claim to the title of most infamous warden on the council after Donald Morgan's death. For Ariana, what a coup. And after that, presumably, a coup. Of course, if the Red King was holding the knife, he got the best of all worlds. Dead enemies, more prestige, and a more secure throne. No brainer. He took the knife from my belt, smiling, and turned toward the altar. and my daughter.
Dear God, I thought. Think, Dresden, think!
One day, I hope God will forgive me for giving birth to the idea that came next. Because I never will. I knew how angry she was. I knew how afraid she was. Her child was about to die only inches beyond her reach, and what I did to her was as good as murder. I focused my thoughts and sent them to Susan.
Susan, think!
Who knew who the baby's father was? Who could have told them? Her lips peeled away from her teeth.
His knife can't hurt you,
I thought, though I knew damn well that no fairy magic could blithely ignore the touch of steel. Martin, Susan said, her voice low and very quiet, did you tell them about Maggie? He closed his eyes, but his voice was steady. Yes. Susan Rodriguez lost her mind. One instant she was a prisoner, and the next she had twisted like an eel, too swiftly to be easily seen. Martin's machete opened up a long cut on her throat, but she paid as little attention to it as a thorn scratch gained while hiking. Martin raised a hand to block the strike he thought was coming, and it was useless because Susan didn't go after him swinging. Instead, her eyes full of darkness and rage, her mouth opened in a scream that showed her extended fangs, she went for his throat. Martin's eyes were on mine for a fraction of a second, no more, but I felt the soul gaze begin. I saw his agony, the pain of the mortal life he had lost. I saw his years of service, his genuine devotion, like a marble statue of the Red King, kept polished and lovingly tended. And I saw his soul change. I saw that image of worship grow tarnished as he spent year after year among those who struggled against the Red King and his empire of terror and misery. And I saw that when he had come into the temple, he knew full well that he wasn't going to survive, and that he was content with it. There was nothing I could do in time to prevent what was coming next, and I wasn't sure I wanted to. Martin said that it had taken him years and years to run a con on the Fellowship of St. Giles, but it had taken him most of 2 centuries to run the long con on the Red King. As a former priest, Martin must have known of the bloodline curse and its potential for destruction. He must have known that the threat to Maggie and the realization of his betrayal would be certain to drive Susan out of control. He told me already, practically the moment he had come to Chicago, that he would do anything if it meant damaging the Red Court. He would have shot me in the back. He would have betrayed Maggie's existence, practically handing her to the murderous creatures of the Red Court. He would betray the Fellowship to its enemies. He would destroy Susan, and he would die himself. Everything he had done, I realized, he had done for one reason. To be sure that I was standing here when it happened. To give me a chance to change everything. Susan rode him to the stone floor, berserk with terror and rage, and tore out his throat, ripping mouthful after mouthful of flesh from his neck with supernatural speed. Martin died. Susan began to turn, and that was my moment. I flung myself against the wills of the Lords of Outer Night with everything in my body, my heart, my mind. I hurled my fear and my loneliness, my love and my respect, my rage and my pain. I made of my thoughts a hammer, infused with the fires of creation and tempered in the icy power of the darkest guardian the earth had ever known. I raised my arms with a scream of defiance, bringing as much of the armor as I could between my head and theirs, and wished for a fleeting second that I had just worn the stupid hat. And I threw it all at the second lord from the left, the one whose will seemed the least concrete. He staggered and made a sound that I'd once heard from a boxer who'd taken an uppercut to the nuts. With that, the last lord of Outer Night to enter the temple, the one wearing the mask I had seen once before, when Murphy had sliced it from its owner's head, raised her hands and sent ribbons of green and amethyst power scything through her apparent compatriots. The blast killed 2 of them outright, with spectacular violence, tearing their bodies to god-awful shreds and spattering the inside of the temple with black blood. All of the remaining lords staggered, screaming in surprise and pain, their true forms beginning to claw their way free of the flesh that contained them. My godmother, too, discarded her disguise, flinging the gold mask at the nearest lord as she allowed the illusion that concealed her true form to fade away, taking with it the clothes and trappings that had let her insinuate herself among the enemy. Her eyes were bright, her cheeks flushed. Bloodlust and an eager, nearly sexual desire to destroy radiated from her like heat from a fire. She howled her glee and began hurling streaks and bolts and webworks of energy at the stunned lords of outer night, spinning power from her flickering fingertips, even as they brought the force of their wills and their own sorcery to bear upon her. Not one of the lords of outer night remembered to keep me down. I was suddenly free. I hurled myself at the Red King's back with a scream and saw him spin to face me, knife in hand. His dark eyes suddenly widened and the awful power of his will descended upon me like a dozen leaded blankets. I staggered, but I did not stop. I was hysterical. I was not well. I was invincible. My armor and my grandfather's staff and the sight of my frightened child and the cold power flowing through my limbs allowed me to push forward one step and another until I stood nearly toe-to-toe with him. The Red King's restored right hand snapped forward to bury the obsidian knife in my throat. My left hand dropped the staff and intercepted his wrist. I stopped the knife an inch from my throat, and his eyes widened as he felt my strength. His left hand shot out to clench my throat with crushing power. I formed the thumb and forefinger of my right hand into a C-shape, ice crackling as it spread over them, rigid and crystal clear. And then I plunged them into both of his black, black eyes. And then I sent my will coursing down my arm along with all the soul fire I could find as I screamed, "Fuego!" Fire seared and split and cooked and steamed, and the king of the Red Court, the most ancient vampire of their kind, the father and creator of their race, screamed in agony. The sound was so loud that it blew out my left eardrum, a novel new agony for my collection. And when the Red King screamed, every single member of his court screamed with him. This close to him, I could almost feel it. Feel the power of his will calling them, drawing vampires to him with a summoning beyond self-interest, beyond reason. But even if I hadn't been there touching him, the sudden storm of cries from outside would have told me the same story. The vampires were coming toward us in a swarm, a storm, and nothing on earth would stop them from going to their king's aid. His grip on my throat faltered, and he staggered back and away from me. My fingers came free of his head, and I grabbed his knife hand at the wrist with both hands. Then, screaming in rage, coating his arm with frost, I snapped his forearm in half and caught the dagger before it could fall to the floor. Freed, the Red King staggered away, and even blinded and in sanity-destroying pain, he was dangerous. His will, unleashed at random, blew holes in the stone walls. Sorcery lashed out. The scarlet lightning that seemed to be the motif around here, raking over one of his own lords and cutting the struggling vampire in half. The eldest vampire of the Red Court screamed in his agony as a tide of his creatures came to obliterate us. And the youngest vampire of the Red Court knelt on the ground over Martin, staring at her hands. I watched for a second as the skin around her fingers seemed to burst at the tips. Then I saw her fingers begin to lengthen, nails growing into claws, muscle tissue tearing free of skin with audible, obvious torment. Susan stared at them with her all-black eyes, shaking her head, her face a mask of blood. She was moaning, shuddering. "Susan," I said, kneeling down in front of her. The howl of sorcerous energies filled the temple with a symphony of destruction. I took her face in my hands. She looked up at me, terrified and tortured, despair written over her face.
"They're coming," she rasped. "I can feel them. Inside. Outside. They're coming. Oh, God."
"Susan!" I shouted. "Remember Maggie!" Her eyes seemed to focus on me.
They wanted Maggie because she was the youngest, I said, my voice cold. Because her death would have taken us all with her. She contorted around her stomach, which was twisting and flexing and swelling obscenely, but she kept her eyes on my face.
Now you're the youngest, I hissed at her, my voice fierce. The youngest vampire in the entire and literally damned court. You can kill them all.
She shuddered and moaned, and I saw the conflicting desires at war within her. But her eyes turned to Maggie, and she clenched her jaw.
I don't think I can do it. I can't feel my hands.
Harry! Screamed Murphy desperately from outside.
They're coming!
Lightning split the air outside with thunder that would register on the Richter scale. There was a sudden random lull in the cacophony of sorcerous war, no more than a couple of seconds long. Susan looked back at me, her eyes streaming her last tears.
Harry, help me,
she whispered.
Save her, please.
Everything in me screamed no, that this was not fair, that I should not have to do this, that no one should ever have to do this. But I had no choice. I found myself picking Susan up with one hand. The little girl was curled into a ball with her eyes closed, and there was no time. I pushed her from the altar as gently as I could and let her fall to the floor, where she might be a little safer from the wild energies surging through the temple. I put Susan on the altar and said, "She'll be safe, I promise." She nodded at me, her body jerking and twisting in convulsions, forcing moans of pain from her lips. She looked terrified, but she nodded. I put my left hand over her eyes. I pressed my mouth to hers, swiftly, gently, tasting the blood and her tears, and mine. I saw her lips form the word, Maggie. And I used the knife. I saved a child. I won a war. God forgive me.
Chapter 49. Everything changed the night the Red Court died. It made the history books. First, for the unexplained destruction of several structures in Chichen Itza. 1,000 years of jungle hadn't managed to bring the place down, but half an hour of slugfest between practitioners who know what they're doing can leave city blocks in ruins. It was later attributed to an extremely powerful localized earthquake. No one could explain all the corpses, some of them with dental work featuring techniques last used 100 years before, some whose hearts had been violently torn from their chests, and whose bodies had been affected by some kind of mutation that had rendered their bones almost unrecognizable as human. Fewer than 5% of them were ever identified, and those were all people who had abruptly gone missing in the past 10 or 15 years. No explanation was ever offered for such a confluence of missing persons, though theories abounded, none of them true. I could have screamed the truth from the mountaintops and blended right in with the rest of the nuts. Everyone knows that vampires aren't real. Second, it made the books because of all the sudden disappearances or apparent outright murders of important officials, businessmen, and financiers in cities and governments throughout Latin America. The drug cartels took the rap for that one, even in the nations where they weren't really strong enough to pull such tactics off. Martial law got declared virtually everywhere south of Texas, and 12 revolutions in 8 or 10 different countries all kicked off, seemingly on the same night. I've heard that nature abhors a vacuum. Though if that's true, then I can't figure out why about 99 zillion% of creation is vacuum. But I do know that governments hate 'em and always rush to fill them up. So do criminals. Which probably tells you more about human beings than it does about nature. Most of the nations in South America proper kept their balance. Central America turned into a war zone, with various interests fighting to claim the territory the vampires had left behind them. Finally, it made the books in the supernatural community as the night of bad dreams. Before the next sunset, the Paranet was buzzing with activity, with men and women scattered over half the world, communicating about the vivid and troubling dreams they'd had. Pregnant women and mothers who had recently delivered had been the hardest hit. Several had to be hospitalized and sedated. But everyone with a smidge of talent who was sleeping at the time was troubled by dreams. The general theme was always the same. Dead children. The world in flames. Terror and death spreading across the globe in an unstoppable wave, destroying anything resembling order or civilization. I don't remember what happened when the ritual went off. There's a blank spot in my head about 2 minutes wide. I had no desire whatsoever to find out what was there. The next thing I remember is standing outside the temple with Maggie in my arms, wrapped up in the heavy feather cloak her mother had left behind. She was still shivering and crying quietly, but only in sheer reaction and weariness now, rather than terror. The shackles lay broken on the ground behind me. I don't remember how I got them off her without hurting her. She leaned against me, using a fold of the cloak as a pillow, and I sat down on the top step, holding her, to see what I had paid for. The red cord was dead. Gone. Every one of them. Most of the remains were little more than black sludge. That, I thought, marked the dead vampires. The half-breeds, though, only lost the vampire parts of their nature. The curse had cured them. Of course, it was the vampire inside them that had kept them young and beautiful. I saw hundreds of people on the ground aging a year for every one of my breaths. I watched them wither away to nothing for the most part. It seemed that half-breeds came in a couple of flavors. Those who had managed to discipline their thirst for blood and thus carried on for centuries, and those who had not been half-vampires for very long. Very few of the latter had ranked in the Red King's court. It turned out that most of the young half-vampires had been working for the Fellowship, and many had already been killed by the Reds. But I heard later that more than 200 others had been freed from their curse. But for me, it wouldn't matter how many I'd freed in that instant of choice. No matter how high the number, it would need to be plus one to be square in my book. Inevitably, the Red Court had contained a few newbies, and after the ritual went off, they were merely human again. They, and the other humans, too dim to run any sooner, didn't last long once the Grey Council broke open the cattle car and freed the prisoners. The terror the Reds had inflicted on their victims became rage, and the deaths they suffered as a result weren't pretty ones. I saw a matronly woman who was all alone beat Alamaya to death with a rock. I didn't get involved. I'd had enough for one day. I sat and rocked my daughter until she fell asleep against me. My godmother came to sit beside me, her gown singed and spattered with blood, a contented smile upon her face. People talked to me. I ignored them. They didn't push. I think Leah was warning them off. Ebenezer, still bearing the black staff in his left hand, came to me some time later. He looked at the Lenanshi and said, "Family business. Please excuse us." She smirked at him and inclined her head, then she stood up and drifted away. Ebenezer sat down next to me on the eastern steps of the Temple of Kukulkan, and stared out at the jungle around us, beneath us.
"Dawn's about here," he said. I looked. He was right. "Locals stay hidden in their houses until sunrise around here. Red Court would meet here sometimes, induct new nobility and so on. Survival trait."
"Yeah," I said. "It was like that a lot, especially in nations that didn't have a ton of international respect. Something weird happens in Mexico, 20 million people can say that they saw it, and no one cares.
Sun comes up, they'll be out. They'll call authorities. People will ask questions."
I listened to his statements and didn't disagree with any of them. After a moment, I realized that they were connected to a line of thought, and I said, "It's time to go."
"Aye, soon," Ebenezer said.
"You never told me, sir," I said.
He was quiet for a long moment. Then he said,
"I've done things in my life, Hoss. Bad things. I made enemies. I didn't want you to have them, too. He sighed. At least, not until you were ready.
He looked around at the remains of the Red Court.
Reckon you more or less are.
I thought about that while the sky grew lighter. Then I said,
How did Ariana know?
Ebenezer shook his head.
A dinner. Maggie, my Maggie, asked me to a dinner. She'd just taken up with that Wraith bastard. Ariana was there. Maggie didn't warn me. They had some scheme they wanted my support on. The vampires thought I was just Maggie's mentor then. He sighed.
I wanted nothing to do with it. Said she shouldn't want it either. And we fought. I grunted.
Fought like family.
Yes, he said. Wraith missed it. He's never had any family that was sane. Ariana saw it. Filed it away for future reference.
Is everything in the open now? I asked.
Everything's never in the open, son, he responded. There are things we keep hidden from one another. Things we hide from ourselves. Things that are kept hidden from us. And things no one knows. You always learn the damnedest things at the worst possible times. Or that's been my experience. I nodded. Sergeant Murphy told me what happened. I felt my neck tense.
She saw it?
He nodded.
Reckon so. Hell of a hard thing to do.
It wasn't hard, I said quietly. Just cold.
Oh, Hoss, he said.
There was more compassion in the words than you'd think would go there. Figures in gray gathered at the bottom of the stairs. Ebenezer eyed them with a scowl.
Time for me to go, looks like.
I nudged my brain and looked down at them.
You brought them here. For me.
Not so much, he said.
He nodded at the sleeping child.
For her.
What about the White Council?
They'll get things sorted out soon, he said. Amazing how things fell apart just long enough for them to sit them out.
With Christos running it.
Aye.
He's Black Council, I said.
Or maybe stupid, Ebenezer countered.
I thought about it.
Not sure which is scarier.
Ebenezer blinked at me, then snorted.
Stupid, Hoss. Every time. Only so many black-hearted villains in the world, and they only get uppity on occasion. Stupids everywhere, every day.
How'd Leah arrange a signal with you? I asked.
That, Ebenezer said sourly. On that score, Hoss, I think our elders ran their own game on us.
Elders?
He nodded down the stairs, where the tall figure with the metal-headed staff had begun creating another doorway out of green lightning. Once it was formed, the space beneath the arch shimmered, and all the hooded figures at the bottom of the stairs looked up at us. I frowned and looked closer. Then I realized that the metal head of the staff was a blade, and that the tall man was holding a spear. Within the hood, I saw a black eye patch, a grizzled beard, and a brief, grim smile. He raised the spear to me in a motion that reminded me somehow of a fencer's salute. Then he turned and vanished into the gate. One by one, the other figures in gray began to follow him.
Vaderung, I said.
Ebenezer grunted.
That's his name this time. He doesn't throw in often. When he does, he goes to the wall. And, in my experience, it means things are about to get bad.
He pursed his lips.
He doesn't give recognition like that lightly, Hoss.
I talked to him a couple of days ago, I said.
He told me about the curse, put the gun in my hand for me, and showed me where to point it.
Ebenezer nodded.
He taught Merlin, you know. The original Merlin.
How'd Merlin make out? I asked.
No one's sure, Ebenezer said. But from his journals, he wasn't the kind to go in his sleep.
I snorted. The old man stood up and used his right hand to pull his hood up over his face. He paused and then looked at me.
I won't lecture you about Mab, boy. I've made bargains myself sometimes.
He twitched his left hand, which was still lined with black veins, though not as much as it had been hours before.
We do what we think we must to protect who we can.
Yeah, I said.
She might lean on you pretty hard, try to put you into a box you don't want to be in, but don't let her. She can't take away your will.